Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And good morning. Welcome to What's Next. I'm Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. I'm Jay Moran, your host. We're going to get into a delicate issue, but it's an issue that we all face when it comes to the end of life. We've got with us Kelly Clem, the Vice President of Clinical Education and Patient Advocacy for Hospice Buffalo Palliative Care Buffalo. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jay, for having me.
This is a great opportunity to talk about this because, you know, I've been around for a while myself these many years, and I've known about hospice for many years and have encountered it in a variety of ways. But there are a lot of misconceptions when it comes to hospice care. Let's just start off with just go through, you know, the definitions of a couple things: hospice care versus palliative care.
Sure.
Give us the differentiation there.
Yeah, and it's great that you're asking that to start us off, because it really it warrants, you know, some attention, because there's a lot of misconception out there. You know, hospice was always a known entity for years and years. I've been there for 30, and it was just always hospice was end of life. And then all of a sudden, in the early 2000s, this word palliative care mm-hmm. started creeping into the vernacular. And what we found was that, you know, palliative care, if you look it up, has always existed. It's a French word that is to relieve suffering and to provide comfort. So really, hospice is a palliative care program.
Okay.
But how do we distinguish it in terms of what people can access? So here's the simple explanation. Hospice is end-of-life care. It is a Medicare benefit that was designed to support patients and their families in the last 6 months of life. And we'll talk about that timing
sure,
in a bit.
Okay.
But for the purposes of definition, it really is focused on those last months of life. Palliative care, on the other hand, as an organization and as a service provision, is actually never intended to be just an end-of-life program.
Okay.
Because as many of your listeners know, and we know because we're getting older, that when you have a chronic illness, when you have anything that interrupts your daily life, there's suffering, right? You have physical pain. You have emotional duress on how am I going to continue to work. You might even have spiritual duress, like why is this happening to me, or what's going to happen to me if this gets worse and worse. So every part of a person's domain suffers with illness, and palliative care comes in and helps with that. So there's no time frame. There's no definitive, like you have to be at this point in your disease. And I would argue that when you're diagnosed with a condition like congestive heart failure, liver disease, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, you should be involved with palliative care, because we're going to help those symptoms. We're not looking to cure, but we're there to help those symptoms along while you're seeking cure or seeking some sort of relief. So hospice is end of life for the last 6 months. Palliative care is at any point as long as you have a chronic and progressive disease that has symptoms or issues that you're facing.
And you just named, you know, three or four ailments.
Sure.
Parkinson's. So your organization is currently assisting and helping people
absolutely
through those.
Yes, yes. We have close to, I'm going to quote my number irresponsibly, but anywhere from 750 to 1,000 patients in palliative care, both pediatric and adult. And then we have about 400 patients in hospice care. So actually our palliative care is service provision is actually has a larger census than our hospice care, which would make sense.
Yes.
Right? There's
right.
more people walking around with chronic disease.
Right. So let's stay with palliative care
sure.
for a little bit, because this is an intriguing element, and then gives us all a chance to kind of maybe lay it out for ourselves as we have to eventually,
yeah.
we're going to be making decisions, whether it's for ourselves or for our loved ones as life goes on here. But somebody who, well, again, I the Parkinson's stands out because it's such a... an ailment that, you know, just takes away from a person's quality of life. So somebody is diagnosed with Parkinson's, they could live for several years
truly,
after the diagnosis.
Truly.
Right?
And we have many of our patients, again, both pediatric and adult, who are living with this chronic debilitating disease. The term that we want to make sure that we look at is progressive,
okay.
that we know that the disease is going to progress. Okay. There's going to be remissions. There's going to be exacerbations. So palliative care steps in at the beginning and they say, okay, you've got pain, you've got stiffness, you've got some delays in your speech, you might have some difficulty breathing, difficulty swallowing, all those things that can rear their ugly head with Parkinson's. And we say, let us help you with those symptom issues. And our nurses, our social workers, and our nurse practitioners don't take over the case. That's
okay.
a big misconception,
okay.
too, is that we don't come in and say, okay, all your other specialists step aside. We're now the experts. Oh, no. We still honor what your primary doctor says, what your rheumatology doctor says, any physicians that you have in your care. We become one of those consultants.
Okay.
So we say, okay, if they have pain and stiffness, we're going to recommend this. We don't order it. We recommend it. And we confer with the family, we confer with the patient, and then we ask, is it okay if we call your doctor and make this recommendation? We make the recommendation. Many of the practitioners in our community understand what we do, respect what we do, and they say, yeah, that's a great idea. I'm going to make it part of their plan of care. So we really serve as a consultant. It's no different, Jay, if I walked out of this studio today
right.
and I fell and broke my arm, I would go to, you know, my doctor, or I'd go to an emergency room, and they would diagnose the fractured arm, but they wouldn't take care of it. They would call my primary and he would refer me to an orthopedic doctor.
Right.
That orthopedic doctor is going to look at it and say, yep, Kel, you broke your arm, but it needs surgery. That orthopedic doctor doesn't do the surgery. He refers me to an orthopedic surgeon. Now, the orthopedic surgeon steps in and says, yep, we're going to operate. But because you're 65 years old, I want to get an EKG to make sure your heart can handle being under general anesthesia. So now I have an EKG done and there's a little abnormality. He knows about the abnormality, but he doesn't fix it. He calls the specialist. So every point in that scenario, somebody said, I want the best person taking care of you because this is their specialty.
Right.
That's what palliative care is. We are the specialists in symptom management. We are the specialists in helping families navigate a complex healthcare system. So we're really not people that have a separate entity. We become part of the whole plan of care, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. And I think, and I'd like to continue to put some light on it in the sense that I think the common viewpoint of anybody who's considering healthcare, if you're not really in, if you haven't really had to access it on your own, especially something that's so involved, like some of the things we've already mentioned here, that your primary doctor or that specialist is going to be the person who's going to say, okay, you've got this, and this is the way that we're going to treat this.
Right.
But it seems to me that by having palliative care as somebody, as your organization helping out, maybe a little more, I don't want to be too over on my terminology here, but maybe a little more patient oriented in the sense that a specialist is going to, obviously is going to help out the patient
mm-hmm.
and do its best in terms of that. But when it comes to day in and day out living,
right.
it seems to me like the palliative element is something that obviously right. could help out tremendously.
Absolutely. And here's what you're describing to a T. So you go and see your doctor, right? Or several doctors. You right. have all your appointments and you go home. They don't go home with you.
Right.
You're in the house and now they've given you instructions. Okay, take this and then do this in the morning and don't do this and then make sure you follow up on that. That's a lot for somebody who's sick to manage. It's also a lot for family members because they're going to work. They're leaving dad at home. They're leaving grandma at home. And so they're hoping that all of this makes sense. So now what happens is something falls apart. And where do they end up? In the emergency room.
Right.
And the emergency room says, okay, Dr. So-and-so, your patient's here. They call and they go, oh my God, I just saw him 3 days ago. What happened?
Right.
The instructions were perfect. But there's nobody there to make sure that it's on, you know, that they're following through, that things aren't getting out of hand, that things aren't creeping in that they didn't know about. That's what our palliative care program is.
Right.
We have people going into the home to make sure that the instructions and the care plan and all of the things that the doctors and the nurse practitioners have prescribed and want you to do, that they're being done and that they're able to get to their appointments and that they understand why they don't take this med anymore. All of that knowledge, right? Here's a sad statistic. 12% of what practitioners, what nurses and doctors teach is understood and carried out. 12%. We do a whole bunch of teaching. We throw a ton of information right. at people and they nod their heads. They go, yes, doctor. Thank you. Yep, I get it. And everybody thinks they're clear. There's no real test that they understood. They go home and it all falls apart. Palliative care comes in and says, let us help you understand. And then we call the doctor and they're so grateful because we call them and say, hey, I know you prescribed this. I just wanted to let you know we kept him out of the ER for you because they weren't doing this the right way. And they're like, thank God you were there.
Right.
So that's what it is. It's that they would love to go home and make sure. But in many situations, they can't. So we're their second set of eyes for the doctors and the other specialists.
And I think it also speaks to a couple of elements. How a diagnosis is provided, and, you know, a provider is going to give information, maybe even write things out. But there's also that, I think, human nature to hear what you want yeah. to hear at those yeah. moments, or yes. perhaps being somewhat shocked by sure. what you're hearing and only hearing certain elements of it. So again, back to it, it seems like palliative care offer some nice support to that reality.
I think so. And I think what you're hitting on is that there's an emotional investment in this,
yep.
you know, and we're so quick as, you know, a nurse myself and all of us here, we've got the quick fix for you. But we don't realize that when we're going up on meds, when we're increasing labs, or when we start to take things away from patients, that has an emotional impact. You know, I don't have to take this anymore. How come? Well, you know, at this point, and they hear that at this point, well, what point am I at? And if you don't have a clinician that's trained to see the look on their face, to hear the change in their voice, to see the family start writing feverishly the things that you're saying down, all of those are nonverbal cues that this is an emotional duress, that this patient's in emotional duress and this family needs support. So step in our social worker, step in our therapist, right? So it's a really comprehensive way to manage good times, manage good progress, and to be there when there's some slip-ups or when there's some changes coming down the pike. So you're absolutely, you know, it's an astute observation to know that, you know, it's not just following the instructions. There's an impact on all of those changes and all the things that we do and the things that we don't do that we have to be there to support.
But back to the emotional part of it then, when it comes to hearing that word palliative,
mm-hmm.
There's, I would assume, just based on the numbers you've shared with me, that there is a wall there of sorts, right?
Absolutely.
For a patient to make that call or to go on that referral from
yes.
the doctor to seek palliative care.
Yes.
How do you overcome that?
Well, you know, if I could control the internet, I'd be a rich woman. And it really is just, it's the misconception
okay.
that palliative care, because we have the same goals. Palliative
right.
care and hospice have the same goals: to alleviate suffering, right? Symptom burden. And how can you suffer? Physically, emotionally, spiritually, mentally, financially, and socially.
Right.
all aspects, both serve to alleviate that burden, okay? So no wonder people think they're the same. It's the timing that's different. It's at diagnosis with someone who's got years to live for palliative care, and it's at the end of the journey, as it were, for the person who needs hospice. So when you look up palliative care, guess what links come up? Hospice links.
Right.
It's all hospice. So it feeds the myth. It perpetuates the misconception out there. Then you've got doctors and nurses who understand that the palliative care team is called in when they need to sign a do not resuscitate.
Mm-hmm.
That's one very small component of advanced directives that we all should be involved in. It shouldn't be reserved for the palliative care doctor, but it is. So now everybody's thinking, yep, it's time to change my course. It's time to start thinking of comfort versus cure. And that's not what palliative care's role is. We will certainly do that because it's part of what we can do, but it's not its original intent. The original intent is to get in early. So it's really just having, you know, lectures at UB and any other medical student, you know, and doctors, and speaking at all the hospitals and in the emergency rooms and in the clinics, so that all of them have an awareness of what palliative care is, but what it's not, and that they can convey that appropriately to their patients and families.
I think the numbers you said earlier were, for that are currently part of the palliative program, what did you say, 750?
Yeah, and I would suggest that with our older demographic here,
that's probably pretty low.
Horribly low, yeah. Right? When you think of, and I can tell you, when I do a lot of speaking for, you know, the medical residents and the like, and when I start talking about what palliative care is afterwards, they're all coming, I could think of 12 patients right now that I would, you know, be referring. I had no idea. I didn't know that you could do that early. So it's really fascinating that in 2026, halfway through, that we're still having this difficulty to penetrate that concept or that misconception. It's huge out there. But again, I really think people go to Google and WebMD and they just kind of look this up and they just make these assumptions. So it's just, we just got to have a larger reach. And this show really, you know, really fosters that. So we're very grateful.
So in terms of self-advocacy, then, I'm sure there's somebody listening right now who has a diagnosis, yeah, and they're contending with it right now.
Yep.
And they're hearing what we're talking about here in terms of palliative care. What can they do?
So what I would say is, you know, the
besides going to the internet and getting bad information.
Yeah, don't go there. Actually, come to us. Come to the source, right? Because it's right here in your own backyard.
Yeah.
So all we ask is that people give us a call.
Okay.
And here's the greatest thing. If we don't think you're appropriate, or if we can, you know, we might just go in for palliative care for 3 visits and then just say, you're good.
Right.
See you later. We have no required amount of days to be admitted, no required amount of days that you can, you know, have to leave. So it's really just a phone call like you'd be calling a cardiologist or anybody else. There's no fear involved, or shouldn't be.
Sure.
Because we're not going to do anything that wouldn't make sense for you. And you're going to really find, like, here's the general statement that everybody makes. Why didn't I call you sooner?
Right.
Why didn't I do this a year ago? Why didn't I think of palliative care then? Why didn't my doctor tell me about this? How could this have been available to me and my family? And they say the same thing about hospice. Palliative care, and I'm going to share the you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And
okay.
Here's the ugly part. There is a reimbursement issue.
All right.
Okay. So Medicare and Medicaid, it took them a long time, actually, to finally jump on the hospice wagon. And they did so in the late 60s because there was a grassroots movement of volunteers. And they saw what? All the medical bills started to disappear because people were in hospice and they weren't pursuing curative therapy. And Medicare jumped in and said, you know, they didn't say philanthropically, this is good for our constituents. Unfortunately,
right.
They
right.
said we could save a boatload of money.
Okay.
So they bought into the hospice for, and that's why it's 6 months, because that's all they would agree to pay for.
All right.
It has nothing to do with that. Palliative care has not quite gotten there yet with Medicare and Medicaid. There are programs like Independent Health and Highmark who have a rider, okay, through Medicare, if you have the Medicare Advantage program. And I'm not well-versed in insurance, but
sure.
I do know that there's not the same reimbursement structure. So if you have a local insurance here, we're going to run it through and make sure that palliative care is covered by your insurance. So there are some people that unfortunately we can't serve because they don't have that the right insurance yet.
Right.
But if you're in dire straits, I will tell you that, you know, we're a not-for-profit agency. We're not going to let you suffer either.
Sure.
So we have done, you know, pro bono work. We have done charity care. But we have to make sure that we're going through all of the, you know, the process first. So there may be limitations for some people in your audience, but we want them to call anyway, because we're going to get you hooked up. We're not going to desert you. We're not going to abandon you. We'll find a way to make sure that we take care of you. One way or another.
On What's Next this morning, we're talking with Kelly Clem, the Vice President of Clinical Education and Patient Advocacy for Hospice Buffalo and Palliative Care Buffalo. I want to stay with the palliative care issue here, because now you've outlined it, and I appreciate you, you know, giving us as you call it, the ugly or the bad of,
sure.
of it. But money is also a big part of it.
Yeah.
But let's get into then the service that would be provided, or services or recommended services mm-hmm. then. What might somebody who now, okay, again, we don't know the diagnosis. We don't know what somebody's suffering from. But what might they get out of palliative care that might come to a reimbursement issue, and you know, and what they might need to make a cost benefit decision?
Sure. So if you are in our palliative care program, what we're going to provide is that in-home service.
Okay.
Okay. And again, to clarify, it's not hands-on care. We're not doing shift nursing. We're not staying with the patient. We are sort of an omniscient viewer of your health status and where you're progressing to. So if you, let's use congestive heart failure. Let's use a very common COPD, CHF, very common in Buffalo, thanks to sports teams and chicken wings and beer. That was so sad last night. Anyway, we would come in. We'd have a nurse who sort of takes charge. She's like air traffic control. Mm-hmm. So all things go through the nurse. And then right beside her would be a social worker. Because as we know, that emotional and that family piece is so important. They coexist, right? And so we have to have that social work piece. They're not going in and looking at, you know, the dust on your mantle. They're not.
Right.
It's not a social services. It's really emotional support and financial support for resources that exist. There's so many grants. There's so many resources that are available that people aren't aware of. So we help with that. We're going to see you, depending on your symptom issues, maybe once or twice a month. So it's not like this, we don't implode into your home and just, you know, see you every day unless you need it. We're going to review your medications. We're going to speak with all of your specialists and your primary doctor. We're going to make sure that if you're having trouble sleeping, if you're having trouble breathing, if you have a vacation that you want to go on and you need to know, how do I manage if the heat gets too bad? What should I do? All those questions. We're going to be there for you as a resource, and we're going to convey those concerns to your doctors, and then we're going to teach you and make sure that you're on the right path. Say 2 months down the road, you have a horrible exacerbation. You call us at 2 o'clock in the morning. You don't want to go to the emergency room because you know it's packed there, and you don't want to sit in a waiting room. God bless all of the people who work in these emergency rooms right now, what they're going through. So we come out and we say, you know what? We're going to call the doctor on call. We're going to, you know, just adjust some of these medications. We're going to stay here with you. So you have that benefit of the possibility of us being able to manage it in your home as opposed to going to the emergency room. That's one of the greatest benefits that the insurance companies recognized here.
Okay.
We're helping them.
Right.
Because they're not incurring an ER charge. They're not going into the ICU because we've caught it at its beginning. We train our patients and families. I don't care how simple, I don't care how mild the symptom may be. If you start to feel something, call us right away.
Okay.
And we get there before it becomes out of control.
So your people are advising the patient in advance of what to expect.
Yes. And we make sure that they know if we think you need the ER, if it's beyond our ability, we don't say you can't go.
Right.
Go, right? But we're going to be in constant communication with your doctor to make sure that if you do have to go, they know what was happening at home, they know what was being taken at home as far as medications and treatments, and they know what's probably going to be needed when they come back, because you've got eyes on the prize at home, because we're in there 24/7. That's the piece. We're available to people so that we can give that bird's eye view. If you talk to a family member in crisis, what do? They have hypered speech,
right.
Pressured speech. The doctor's trying to get and ascertain information. And I'm not saying that they don't know what they're talking about. It's a scary
exactly.
moment. And so you need somebody there to just sort of pull all those pieces together and give that sort of overview of what's happening and take a step back back and say, what are we going to do to move this forward?
And just for all of us who I think have been through this, I can't say all of us have been through this, but if you have been, you have an elderly parent perhaps who has to go to the emergency room or went to the emergency room many times during the middle of the night or early in the morning or all of these. I don't want to, again, libel the situation in emergency rooms, but that you want to see suffering and anxiety inside an emergency room with when you're with your loved one who is struggling and you see overworked nurses and doctors trying to attend to everybody. If you can stay out of that situation, that's an invaluable benefit.
Yeah, and they want it too. I think that, you know, again, our empathy for what these emergency rooms and hospitals in general and nursing homes are going through because of nursing shortages, because of the complexities of the whole healthcare system. You know, nobody's feeling badly if you figure it out at home. They're like, Godspeed, right?
Right.
Take care. That's wonderful that you didn't have to come. It's not that they won't take care of you or don't want you there, but if it can be managed, my goodness, why wouldn't we want that? That's the intent, is to keep people home and keep them safe and comfortable.
Let's take a break here. We'll come back with more with Kelly Clem from Hospice Buffalo Palliative Care Buffalo. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media and PR.
Corey here with the Compact Civics Expansion Pack.
America is such a big, wide, awesome place, and to be able to see things that are representative of so many different places can be so important when brought to your tiny town.
Everybody is so kind and loving. I'm here in Buffalo just because of Stitch Buffalo.
From urban farms to rural fairs, we'll celebrate spaces that bring us together and create community.
Watch on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
A lot has been happening at your local public media station this past year. Want to know the status of things and get some insight into our plans for the future? Then Buffalo Toronto Public Media invites you to listen to our second State of the Stations on Wednesday, May 27th at 7:30 p.m. You'll hear from many of our organization's key decision makers in a critical and thoughtful live conversation. Watch on BTPM PBS and our BTPM YouTube channel, or listen to BTPM NPR and BTPM Classical. Join us May 27th at 7:30 p.m.
From Reading Rainbow to Masterpiece, BTPM has inspired generations of thinkers, dreamers, and doers. Still growing with you, still sparking curiosity, still illuminating the possible. This is Public Media.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues facing the communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern we should be addressing? Email us at whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that matter. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media and PR.
And welcome back to What's Next. I'm Jay Moran. With me, Kelly Clem, Vice President, Clinical Education and Patient Advocacy for Hospice Buffalo Palliative Care Buffalo. We've been into a pretty in-depth conversation about palliative care here, but let's also give you a chance here, Kelly, to dispel, like as you said and you've referred to many times already, some of the misinformation or misconceptions about palliative care. There is no timeline, right? There's no... If you start palliative care at X time, that you're going to die in Y time, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I think, you know, instead of, I think it's hard for people to know, okay, but when should I call, right?
Sure.
So we have a lot of print information and this opportunity to sort of say, if you find that despite the medications, you still feel lousy. And when I say lousy, I don't mean that you have like severe pain. You could, but I'm just saying you don't have the energy level that you do. You know, family's coming over and you're retiring early. You're finding yourself in the ER 3-4 times a month or, you know, in the last 2 months. So ER visits are a great trigger. Feeling fatigued is a great trigger. Feeling overwhelmed with all the things that you have to remember. It doesn't have to be a physical condition. That mental anguish of, I've got this, it's so complicated now because I've got to take my glucose before I take this pill. And then if it's not in this range, I have this. So just the complexities of the medical onslaught of information and treatment that you're undergoing, all that's a palliative care referral. Like I said, it might take us 4 or 5 visits to get you on the right track, maybe write out some instructions that that are easy to follow, create a chart for you. We do all of that. It's nothing's too simple or too complex. And it could be that we're absolutely, you know, helping you breathe and getting you the right drugs at the same time, you know, through the relationship that we have with your physician. So anything's on the table, but the biggies are fatigue, fear, feeling overwhelmed with the complexities, and those ER visits. If you're going back and forth and back and forth to the ER, something's not right. Something needs to be looked at in that home so we can just, in, like, you know, sort of break that chain of, I go to the ER to take care of my symptoms. You don't have to.
So there's that physical side, which may be dealt with medication, but you mentioned the anxiety, the fear. Mm-hmm. How is that? How does your organization contend with that? How do you assist a patient in that regard? Yeah. Because that's got to be, I mean, I don't know how anybody really contends day in and day out
with
knowing
those two.
With those things.
And I think we underplay it so much because we're so focused on, you know, the what's, you know, so frontal, which is our physical condition. But the wear and tear of anxiety and fear are far greater in terms of leading you to your detriment and your end of life than your physical nature. So what we do is we simplify. Okay. We say, let us take your burden. Let us look at everything and let us see. You know, and again, this is not to disparage anybody, but people are on drugs because of the drugs that they're on.
Right.
Sometimes it means just sort of rethinking the whole process of, you know, why are you on this med? I can tell you that we can ask the patient, the family, and two of their doctors, and nobody will have a recollection of why something was started. And again, it's just the nature of how we, you know, how we practice. And again, I'm not disparaging the clinicians out there and the practitioners that prescribe, but sometimes there's things called drug holidays or just, you know, just taking a break and seeing, you know, where are we now? Let's see what the baseline looks like, and then we can start adding in. So sometimes it's something like that. If that frightens patients and family, well, I've taken this for years, I don't want to stop, so be it. That's an important piece. You are in charge. We are only there to help and to offer support and make recommendation. If you say, nope, I don't want to go that route, that is probably the most healthy thing you could say,
right?
Because you still own your personhood, right? And we honor and support that. So it's really simplifying for the patient who's overwhelmed. If there's anxiety, you know what we do? So oftentimes we forget to say, and I teach this all the time to new clinicians. I always say, when you hear that somebody has anxiety, what do you think we do? And they'll raise their hand. They'll say, well, you give Ativan or you give Xanax, right? Or you'll have a therapist come in. I go, ask them what they're worried about. Mm-hmm. How about starting there?
Right.
I'll tell you a great story. My grandmother was dying, and she was rock solid, right? And she was at the end of her, you know, beautiful life, and everybody was okay with it. We have spiritual belief that, you know, heaven was waiting for her and all of that. So everybody was in a good place. And I went to see her one day, and she was as nervous as all get out. She was fidgety. She was hyperventilating a little bit. And I called, her name was Roseanne, and I called her Roses. And I said, Roses, I go, what is wrong? And she said, I can't tell you. And I went, oh my goodness. I said, I'm your favorite. You have to tell me. I'm just 42 grandchildren, but I'm the one. And she said, it's about you and I don't want to hurt you. And I went, oh, sweet mother. I said, you have to tell me. I said, I can't have you die and not know what this is. And she goes, you promised not to get mad at me. I said, I will not get mad at you. And she goes, okay, you're not getting the rings. She had two huge diamonds, I mean, like massive, right? And she did not leave them to me in the will. And she thought I was going to be upset. Now, Jay, you look at me. Do I look like I would be sporting a lot of diamond wear? No, right? I don't wear makeup. I don't wear jewelry, right? And I said, Roses, I said, I don't want your rings. And she said, you don't? Like she was shocked. And I said, no. I said, I want your potato masher. Because that's the first thing you taught me how to cook.
Mm.
You let me mash your potatoes. And I said, I want your recipe box because it has your handwritten notes in there. That's all you want? I said, that's all I want. Anxiety, gone.
Mm.
So you see, Jay, it's sometimes so easy, so simple. We forget to ask them. We forget to talk to patients. That's what palliative care does. We have the luxury of time. Those ER doctors, those nursing home team nurses, those social workers that are running themselves ragged, they don't have that luxury. In fact, that's why a lot of people come and work for us, because we're told you have to be in that home for at least an hour. You get that benefit. We don't take that for granted, but we use it to our advantage to make sure that we understand the intimate components of their suffering and their joy.
It's interesting in your personal story, and I appreciate you sharing about your grandmother, that you mentioned you didn't want her to die and not tell you what was on her mind, but the discussion about death, where does that come in this process? I mean, is it up to the patient to kind of bring it up? I mean, where does that fall in?
Yes.
This is an interesting.
And we often find there's all these phrases that, hospice, sort of language, right? The big white elephant in the room. Okay. And people use that for other issues as well. So everybody knows that they're dying, but nobody wants to say the word, right? So we take a pretty comfortable approach with that word. Like we don't say, we use the word dying.
Right.
We use the word death. Because if we're not comfortable with ourselves, how can we expect people to be comfortable? So we have to assume that position of this is a part of life. But we're also very delicate in how we, introduce that. We have had people, Jay, in hospice care,
right,
who have met us at the driveway when we're coming. Okay, mom doesn't know she's dying. Mm. We told her you're just a home care agency and we don't want you to bring up the word hospice. So would you turn your badge around or take it off? And so we stay in the driveway and we say, we respect your right to, have what you want shared. But if your mother is oriented and lucid and able to communicate with us, we can't hide who we are. We can't pretend to be something that we're not. Mm. And more importantly than that, the first thing that they said, mom doesn't know she's dying. I would venture to say, yes, she does.
Right.
She doesn't let you know. She may not talk to you about it, but there's very few people out there who are dying that don't know that they're dying. It's like you don't need a diagnosis to tell you have a cold. You know you don't feel well. You know you don't have the energy. The fatigue is there. The you're feeling withdrawn. You're feeling like you're, starting to, the walls are closing in, as it were. It's not an epiphany that somebody all of a sudden reveals to someone. There's a sense that this is happening. Now, mind over matter. Are they fighting it? Sure. But what are they fighting? They have to admit that there's something to fight,
right,
to try and stay alive or to try and stay at the kitchen table for as long as they can because it's Thanksgiving dinner. We respect all of that, right? And again, the patient's in charge. So we tell families, we respect your desire to protect, but we also think that they may need somebody to talk to about this because we don't have, and we don't come in and say, we want you to know you are in a program that is 6 months or less. We don't have to deliver it that way, but we don't shield ourselves. I'll tell you another great story. Had a young boy whose mother and father were contemplating hospice, and I went out to see them, and he was nine. And I'm sorry, he was six. And they said, you're allowed to come in and take care of him, but you are never to tell him that he's dying because we don't want to frighten him. And for a parent, I had a little bit of a different approach. And I said, I promise you, I will never tell him that he's dying. I said, but I also must make sure you know that if he asks me or he alludes to that issue, that I won't lie. And they were so confident that he had no idea, because he was six, that they were fine with that and they agreed to that. So I was taking care of him. I was about a month in, and he was now making some significant progression towards his death. And there were all these people in his room, and he was in his bed, and I was kneeling down at his bedside because I was administering, medications and taking care of him. And he looked at me, and they only spoke Spanish, so I had an interpreter there, but he spoke English. And he looked at me and he said, am I dying? And I instantly was taken back to that exchange that we had at the kitchen table. And I felt as though I needed to honor them to the utmost. And I said, what do you think? And I rarely answer a question with a question,
right,
but in this instance, I wanted to give his parents every opportunity. And he goes, I think I am. And I said, and I think you are. Mm-hmm. And I said, what are you worried about? And he said, I want them to be okay. He didn't say anything about himself. And his parents saw that he was struggling to breathe a little bit. And they asked me through an interpreter, can we send him to the hospital if this continues? And I have to abide by the parents. And I said, if that's what you feel is best, then that's what I think you should do. And he looked at me and he pointed his little six-year-old finger at me and he said, I go nowhere. He said, you make sure of that. He told me to make sure. So I said, he can't go. He doesn't want to go. He's okay. And they let him die at home. And it was an absolutely stunning, beautiful death with his family around. So they know. That's what I want your listeners to know. They know. And they're okay. They just need to be able to share that with somebody sometimes.
And Kelly, again, I appreciate you sharing the story.
Sure.
But the question now that follows is how do you and your colleagues cope with being part of this reality pretty much throughout your professional lives?
Yeah. I think because we've seen the alternative. I think we reframe it for ourselves, and that's something that we do teach, is how can you look at this situation and not crumble? How can you be in the midst of this? And you know, there's cognitive empathy and there's emotional empathy, and we have to have a balance. We can't be all emotional. We can't be Thelma and Louise and, you know, driving off the cliff
right,
with them.
Right.
Because the families will end up comforting us. Right. They'll give us water and tissues. Right. We can't have that. But we have to have a cognitive awareness of what will the alternative be if I wasn't here? Or what would the alternative be if hospice and palliative care weren't available? And when we put it in that perspective, we're able to uplift. And I can tell you that it's a life-affirming experience, because what happens, Jay, is that you leave a home of a child who's dying. You leave a home of a, you know, a 60-year relationship in marriage and the spouse dies. And you change the way you live. You don't take your husband or your wife or your significant other for granted. You don't take your children for granted. You wait in Wegmans in the 15 items or less lane, and they've got 22 items in front of you, and you don't get angry anymore.
Right, right.
Because time is of the utmost. So if you really put it into perspective and you train your mind to say, what can I learn from this? What can I benefit? How can I keep myself in the affirming as opposed to in the despairing? And it's really looking at their life being better because of the care that we were able to provide, and then turning that around and saying, my life is going to be better because I've learned from every patient and family that I've cared for.
Let's take another time out, our final time out on What's Next, and we'll come back and talk more with Kelly Clem, the Vice President of Clinical Education and Patient Advocacy for Hospice Buffalo Palliative Care Buffalo. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media and PR.
Public media starts here, in our neighborhoods, our schools, our city halls, where decisions meet real life. BTPM NPR's local reporters are asking the questions that matter, listening to the people affected, and explaining what it all means for our region.
There's a lot of poor record keeping. There are records that list that don't reconcile with other lists. There's a lot of gasoline that's being used that isn't properly accounted for. And there are a lot of people with take-home vehicles.
That's Erie County Comptroller Kevin Hardwick. He's outlining just a few of the issues his office found when conducting an audit of the county's vehicle fleet.
From paper trails to public impact, this is journalism that stays with the story and with the community it serves. Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR produces journalism with depth, care, and purpose. This is Public Media.
What is BTPM Plus? It's an evolution of Buffalo Toronto Public Media that brings you the best of PBS, where you can watch your favorite programs live and dig into collections curated just for you. And here's the best part. When you stream BTPM Plus, you're not just watching, you're supporting your local public media station, the journalism, the arts, and the storytelling that keeps our community connected. Visit btpm.org/plus today. Stream smarter, stream local.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues facing the communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern we should be addressing? Email us at whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that matter. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR.
And welcome back to What's Next. We continue our conversation with Kelly Clem, the Vice President of Clinical Education and Patient Advocacy for Hospice Buffalo Palliative Care Buffalo. And Kelly, we've spent quite a bit of time talking about palliative care and getting into the definitions of palliative v. hospice care. And I appreciate we've been able to take this conversation as well. But we don't want to leave the conversation without really getting into the heart of it, and that is hospice care. Again, you use that 6 months time frame before. I guess that's the way Medicare, Medicaid view when hospice is meant to be implemented so it can be reimbursed and right. things along those lines. We'll save those conversations exactly. where people can really get into them. But let's talk about then hospice care. One of the issues is that unfortunately a lot of people don't get in at 6 months. It's considerably shorter time before their end comes.
Yes. And it's, so we don't make any money if you come in earlier, and that's an important feature because, the reimbursement doesn't even begin to cover what we provide as services to patients and families. And we're fine with that. Our community is exceptionally generous and we're able to reinvest their generosity into more services. But I think that the true sadness after 30 years of seeing people still coming in at 48 hours before they die or, a week before is what they miss because the comprehensive care that hospice provides in the home 24/7 is unmatched in any other health industry or health continuum. And it really is part of the continuum, right? So, when you have access to a physician, a nurse practitioner, a nurse, a social worker, a spiritual counselor, massage therapy, art therapy, pet therapy, a home health aide, a volunteer, and then 13 months of grief support for anyone who's suffering the loss of that person. Doesn't have to be an immediate family. It can be your best friend. It could be somebody you played bridge with. We're going to provide all of that for free. There's no charge. All your medications are covered for. All your treatment, all your equipment, your bed, your wheelchair, your walker, your over-the-bed stand, your oxygen. This is unmatched and unheard of in today's society. And so in order for us to have you experience the breadth and scope of what we have, you can't do that in 48 hours. We can't even get, an eighth of our services in. So we want people to know that 6 month is a Medicare rule. But again, the same triggers. If you're not feeling well, if you're exhausted, if the medicines aren't working and you're going to the ER and you're tired of it and you need somebody to say, you know what, there's a different way that we can approach these last stages of your life. Like I said, Jimmy Carter was in program right. for a year right. and everybody's like, well, I thought hospice was for 6 months. It's designed to be that way. But the Medicare language actually says, as long as the disease follows its normal course. Well, when you're in hospice, guess what? The disease isn't in control anymore. You are. And we are in control of what makes the death come sooner, the lack of symptom management. We talked about anxiety and fear and how that wreaks havoc on your body. So does pain. If we eliminate that, guess what? All of a sudden, you're feeling better. You're engaging with your family. So we want you to know that if you're starting to feel those symptoms of fatigue, if you just don't feel right and you have a condition that is considered terminal, we can come in and support that. So don't worry about waiting until you're imminently dying. We'll help you. We'll do great work, but you're not getting the full benefit of what hospice can provide. So call us. If you're not ready for hospice, if you're not eligible, we have to tell you. But we'd rather you call and have us say, you're not there yet, as opposed to call us at the end when we say, okay, here's what we're limited to because your death is right around the corner.
There's also, of course, through the dealing with a disease, there are ways to treat it along the way, right? I will use cancer and whether chemotherapy, sure. radiation therapy,
sure.
Among the options. At the same time, there comes a point, I think, depending on the disease and whatever stage, if you want to use stages mm-hmm. in terms of cancer, where there's a decision to be made, right? Yeah. Whether or not you want to seek additional treatments. What about that? How can hospice
navigate
through all that? Because I guess that's the question. I guess, right. Am I going to take chemotherapy or go to hospice? I mean,
right.
am I?
Yes. And there
yes
are choices.
No?
And okay. I would be remiss if I didn't say, you know,
sure.
that the expectation is that you are willing to forego the pursuit. A lot of times people say you're willing to forego curative therapy, but I say words matter and
all
words
right.
are important. If the cure was there, you'd be, and you're seeking cure, great. But if the treatment is not promising cure, then you're pursuing the, you know, you're looking for the pursuit of cure, which isn't there. So you can't
okay.
give up something that isn't there.
All right.
So we ask you to acknowledge that the treatment has now become futile.
Okay.
And that...
So that is that is something you
it
have
is,
to
you would have to choose.
That.
Now, there's
okay.
some treatments that will, you know, that we will grandfather it because it's called, it's like a salvage treatment. It keeps the symptoms at bay.
Yes.
But if you're pursuing cure, then psychologically, you're not ready for hospice.
Gotcha.
And we support that. Godspeed again. But at the same time, many patients are like, I'm tired. I don't want to go back for more transfusions. Mm-hmm. I'm tired. I don't want another round of chemo. We're their safety net. And we can say, that's okay.
Mm.
And we're going to... And sometimes the treatment is the enemy.
Right.
Sometimes the death will come sooner because of the treatment. Not in every case. And I'm not disparaging treatment, you know, protocols. But there comes a time when it's not going to work. And we can help you through that process of acknowledging that. But we respect your decision wherever it is. If you change your mind and you want to go back and try one more round, we help you. We discharge you. And we say, we're right here when you want to come back. If you don't come back, awesome. We celebrate the victories in your life with treatment, and we're there to celebrate the joy that comes from acknowledging that this is your time.
And we talked about this thing off air, but I want you to give you a chance to totally dispel it. There's this, again, wherever this general kind of conversation comes, that once you're in hospice, there's going to be drugs, and the drugs
yeah.
are going to lead to your
yeah.
Imminent death within a certain time frame.
Yeah. As the patient advocate, that's my number one referral, is explaining to patients and families and the community at large that we do not hasten death with drugs. In fact, as a person gets closer to death, we're actually reducing the amount of drugs that they're taking. But we do not use morphine, Ativan, Seroquel, or Haldol to move people to an unresponsive state. We get them comfortable through the minimum amount necessary. And if they sleep, it's because they can.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really hard to prove that to somebody, but I can assure you that we are not ever with the focus of hastening death at any point.
And also, we'd love to the great movie ending where the person jumps up on
yeah.
the bed and goes. But does that happen
yeah.
once in a while? Does somebody all of a sudden take reversal?
There's a phenomenon, like they call it the rally,
uh-huh.
or they call it, there's like this final gift
yeah.
where they will have a day or two of lucidity and they'll eat. I've had people order Kentucky Fried Chicken and mashed potatoes and 12 hours later they were gone.
Right.
And those don't happen, you know, it's not common. But the phenomenon is there and we caution families, like this is not them traveling back up the slippery slope, but we just say, just enjoy this moment that they're giving you and celebrate this time together.
And then finally, you mentioned, of course, hospice is nonprofit. We talked about the reimbursement issue. So these different events that we see and hear with hospice,
yes.
whether walks or
yeah.
things along those lines, these really
they matter.
They matter.
They matter. The Medicare reimbursement is frightening.
Mm.
It doesn't even cover the cost of half of the medications that we use. So all the services that we provide, you know, and you have to consider our overhead. We have mileage checks. We have cell phone bills. We have computer tablets. Everything comes out of that. So the donations that people make to hospice are reinvested. We have a pet therapy dog named Hudson.
He's okay.
a Bernese Mountain Dog. He brings incredible endorphin joy to so many people. We had to buy him, you know, so we reinvest into services. We don't put it in, you know, the pockets and build big buildings or all of that. We reinvest it into the services that are going to help our community because they've been so generous to us.
As we've highlighted more than once in this program, a lot of misinformation,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
What's the best way to get the right information?
Call us.
Yeah.
Call me. Call anybody at hospice. Our number is 716-686-8000, or you can go on our website, which is hospiceandpalliativecarebuffalo.com. But we're always here.
And Lori, Kelly, we've got 90 seconds to go here. I'm just kind of curious about your personal journey then.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how about for you dealing... I use the word dealing. I'll let you use the word
yes.
how you live day in and day out You've been in hospice now for 30 years. How about for you? What does it mean for you?
It's been an absolutely glorious realization of how to appreciate what you have in life. I'm working hard, and I'm not a mindfulness person, and I don't journal. I'm not into all that. And God bless all those who are.
Sure.
But I really love just parking in the farthest parking spot now, and walking slowly through whatever task I'm doing, whether it's taking the dog for a walk or going grocery shopping, and just appreciating color and sound and smiles and joy. And really, that's a gift to be able to do that. And I do it on behalf of all the patients that have died who said, don't miss the stuff. Just absorb it all. So I do it for them. And that's kept me grounded.
Well, Kelly Clem, really appreciate the conversation, taking us through a lot of delicate subject matters, but doing it very well. We really appreciate
this. This was great. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
This has been a great show, as a matter of fact. And we do appreciate Kelly Clem, Vice President of Clinical Education and Patient Advocacy at Hospice Buffalo Palliative Care Buffalo. If you're just tuning in and finding out what's the difference or wondering about the difference between hospice and palliative, I suggest you go online and listen to this program and go back to the beginning.
Because
we had, I think Kelly did a great job of taking
you
through. So thank you so much for your time. This has been What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR.
Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.